it's got on to something I feel more confident, slightly more confident in doing. If you have your Bible with you, if you'll open up to 2 Kings chapter 8 tonight. We have been looking at mostly the stories of Elisha, who is the successor of Elijah, and the various things that have been going on in the Northern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom, remember, is the split from Israel. Israel has gone through a civil war, a civil division, and the Northern Kingdom is its own entity, separate from the Southern Kingdom of Judah, where Jerusalem is. The Northern Kingdom had gone off into idolatry, and so we looked at all the various things that have happened within the Northern Kingdom. Something sounds really weird to me in this right now. What's going on? I got an echo or something, or maybe turn me down a little bit. It's really loud, at least for me. And I'm unnerved as it is. That's better or not? It still sounds weird. Do we have effects on this? Do we have effects on? Am I overdriving? It sounds a little bit like I'm overdriving. Still sounds. It's just like it's going through a. You figure it out? There we go. Now let's turn me down a little bit, please. Whew. I will be glad when this evening is over. All right. How's that? Can you hear me okay? Still sounds weird to me, but I'm not going to worry about it. All right. So what were we talking about? We were talking about Elisha and the Northern Kingdom and the king who now we first had Ahab, who, well, not first, but we were during Elisha's reign. Ahab was the king and he was wicked and evil. And then he passed away and his son Jehoram is now the king over the Northern Kingdom. And so we're still kind of following some of these events. Last week, as we looked at it, Samaria had been laid siege to by the Syrians. Syrians had decided they were going to attack Israel, the Northern Kingdom, and they laid siege, and so there was a terrible famine within the kingdom, and we saw how the Lord predicted that he was going to provide for the people supernaturally, and he did so by driving the Syrians out with a noise, scared them off with a loud sound, and so the word of the Lord came true that way. Now we kind of pick up, and we've got several little stories that kind of go together, kind of don't. So we'll pick up here chapter 8. Let's read the first three verses here. It says, then Elisha spoke with the woman whose son he had restored to life. I don't know if you remember that from back several chapters ago, chapter 4. Woman he had restored to life, saying, arise and go, you and your household, and stay wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine. And furthermore, it will come upon the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God. And she went with her household, and she dwelt in the land of the Philistines for 7 years. And it came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and for her land. Okay, as I said, this is the woman, if you don't remember the events of chapter 4, this is a woman who had been kind to Elisha, had her household built a room for him to stay at when he traveled through the area. And for her kindness, he asked her, what would you like from the Lord? And he realized that she was childless, so he said to her that she was going to have a child. So she has this child, and then after a period of time, the child passes away, maybe from sunstroke, from the way the text looks. And so she appealed to Elisha, and Elisha prayed over the child, and he restored him back to life. So this is that woman. And so, obviously, still because of the kindness that she's been showing to Elisha, I'm sure this has been an ongoing thing where he's been able to stay in that place and she's taken care of him. He is giving her a forewarning about the famine that's coming. And so he gives her a heads up, obviously, from the Lord. Now, as we look at this, you know, we're kind of wondering as we try to piece together the events here, it may feel like, well, didn't we just already see a famine going on? Isn't, you know, what is this? How is this fitting in with the timeline? Again, we have to remember that when we're talking about ancient Eastern types of writings like this, a linear chronology is not necessarily going to be that important to them. So more than likely, we've jumped back. This is like a mini flashback to kind of tell us about some events that happened earlier, before the famine started, and how he sent her away. So, on Elisha's advice, she and her whole family moved to the land of the Philistines to wait out this famine. 7 years, you know, you think about that, that's a long time. I mean, if a person disappears for 7 years, they, you know, declare them dead and everything. So 7 years is a long time to abandon your property, to abandon the stuff that you've got in the land there. So clearly, you know, some things have changed in the interim time. When she goes back, it's apparent that she's forfeited the lands of her ancestors, the lands that were, you know, part of her inheritance. It's interesting, there's no mention of her husband in this. There was in chapter 4, but there isn't now. And so you've got the sense, especially in the fact that she is going to make this appeal to the king, you kind of have the sense that the husband's not on the scene anymore. You know, he's probably passed away. So she is in charge of trying to keep this household together. That's why Elisha speaks to her, and she is the one who takes them out of Israel for that period of time. And when she comes back, she's making this appeal to the king. So we pick up the story then, verse 4. Then the king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me, please, all the great things Elisha has done." Now, it happened, as he was telling the king how he had restored the dead to life, that there was the woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life." And when the king asked the woman, she told him. And so the king appointed a certain officer for her, saying, "Restore all that was hers, and all the proceeds of the field from the day that she left the land until now." Now, okay, so what an interesting little vignette we have portrayed here. I mean, this is the same Gehazi who was struck with leprosy earlier on, back in chapter 5. So we got to try to put it together here. What's happening? I mean, this is kind of a curious scenario here. To have Gehazi, who's been struck with leprosy, in the presence of the king, how can he be talking to the king? So there are several theories when it comes to this kind of stuff. First is the idea that this is something that happened before the events of chapter 5. This is something that took place before Naaman had come and talked with Elisha and stuff. And that's a possibility, as I said. Linear chronological order is not that important to an ancient Eastern mindset. So it's possible that we're kind of jumping around in the timeline as we go on. That's a possibility. The second theory that's put forth is the idea that maybe Gehazi, in repentance, turned to the Lord for help, and the Lord healed him. Maybe he doesn't have leprosy anymore. Maybe the Lord, you know, removed it from him, and it's not a problem anymore. That's a possibility. Thirdly, is the idea that maybe he's got leprosy, but the king either doesn't know about it, or he's in a distant, he's kept far enough away from the king that the king feels comfortable enough to be able to talk with him. Either way, no matter what, however this pans out, you can kind of pick your theory and whatever you think fits best. What's really curious is how things have changed once again. Here, the servant of Elisha is sitting in audience with the king. Now, the last time that we saw Jehoram, he was trying to kill Elisha. He wanted his head. He said, "The Lord do so to me if I don't take off Elisha's head." So, you know, we've seen this kind of thing back and forth all the time. How interesting that here he is. He's, you know, in this situation where he's wanting to hear stories about Elisha. There's always been, it seems like, this kind of strange love-hate relationship between these two men. I mean, you know, at one moment, Elisha's advising him, giving him a word from the Lord, and warning him about things that are going on. The next moment, Jehoram is saying, "I'm going to kill you," you know, and it's okay, you know, and they're back and forth on this kind of stuff all the time. And it's really, I don't know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Now, some have looked at this and said, well, maybe this was conspiratorial. Maybe he's trying to get information about Elisha so that he can either use it against him or trap him somewhere. But the events as they unfold to me don't seem to lead to that kind of conclusion, because when this woman comes in and he's telling these stories about how Elisha raised somebody from the dead, and he looks over and says, "Well, hey, there's the lady right there. Ask her." And she's able to come in and corroborate this story and give some real evidence to the whole thing. Why, his response then is to restore the land. He responds in a favorable way. So it's hard to think that he's being conspiratorial against Elisha in talking to him. So what a curious thing. I mean, Jehoram, I mean, he's back and forth, it seems like, all the time. Sometimes he's listening to Elisha. Sometimes he's wanting his advice. Other times he's angry with them and wanting to take him out. And I don't know, he reminds me a lot of me sometimes in my relationship with God and how I have this tendency as a human being. You know, sometimes I feel like I've got things together, and usually it's around that time that things begin to fall apart because I realize I'm kind of trusting in my ability to keep them together. And then things change over time. I mean, we go back and forth as human beings. It's a curious thing, and I'm not trying to hold him up as an example of an ideal. Well, I don't want to be like that. None of us should want to be like that. We want to be consistent in our relationship with God and our love for him, but it's just an interesting thing how he's portrayed here and how real he seems to be. So, you know, you think about this woman too. She could have gotten really bitter over this whole thing. You know, a prophet comes to her and warns her, hey, you need to get out of here. There's a famine coming. And she listens to him. She says, yeah, cool. That's the word of the Lord. Because she had nothing to base that on apart from the fact that she trusted what Elisha said. And so she takes off, packs everybody up. They jump in the minivan. They take off. They head off to Philistia. And then 7 years later, you come back and everything's gone. You know, that somebody else is living in your house and everything's been given away. And you could imagine her going, I listened to the Lord. I was doing what the Lord told me to do. And now I've lost everything. At least I used to have a place. Even if I was hungry, I wouldn't have been homeless. And yet, in following the Lord on all of these things, and just stepping along, trusting that the Lord's going to unfold it according to his plan and purpose, well, look how that all works. I mean, we can't just call that coincidence. It wasn't coincidence that she shows up in the king's palace just at the right time. You know, God working through all these events that seem like normal events, and yet God weaving his plan together for the good of those that he loves. It could have looked like a terrible situation to her, and yet she comes back and finds she's lost nothing by listening to the Lord and following his will. Those are important things for us to remember as we go along in life, remembering that even though sometimes it looks like things are falling apart after we've gone ahead and given our all to the Lord, I'm giving it all to you, Jesus, you take care of it, you know, and everything crashes, and we could look at that and say, whoa. And yet we realize that God's working out his plan. Doesn't always happen the way we would imagine. I'm sure she didn't sit down and imagine, well, maybe if I go over there, Elisha's servant will be there telling stories. I mean, I'm sure that wasn't part of her plan at all, and yet God is weaving it all together. And those are important things for us to remember to learn, because he's working in ways that we would have never dreamed of in 1,000 years, because his ways are bigger than ours. All right, verse 7. Then Elisha went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, was sick. And it was told him, saying, the man of God has come here. And the king said to Hatsael, take a present in your hand and go meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, shall I recover from this disease? So Hatsael went and met him and took the presents with him of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came, and 40 camel loads, I mean, come on. And he came and stood before him and said, Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from this disease? Okay. Once again, we got to try to work through this and figure this one out. There's gaps in the story here that we've got to kind of, it could leave us a little bit puzzled, because the last time that we read about Ben-Hadad and the leaders of Syria, they were out to get Elisha too. Remember, they're the ones that sent the armies to surround him, and the Lord showed the servant, you know, there's fiery chariots everywhere, everything's going to be okay. I mean, this is the same king who was out trying to destroy things. So, you know, I don't know exactly how this goes. I mean, the other thing that we knew about the Samaritans, not Samaritans, the people from Syria, was that they, you know, had just laid siege to Samaria. So this is either something that takes place before the events of that siege or after the events of that siege. Either way, there's got to be a time span in between, because relationships are normalized enough that Elisha feels comfortable enough just taking a little day trip up to Damascus, going up to a little shopping, some nice antique stores, whatever it is that he's up there for. And you know, he's able to show himself in public to the point where people see him and are able to report it back to the king, you know, the man of God, that prophet dude that you guys, you know, we were really interested in. He's here in town. And so Ben-Hadad, recognizing obviously that Elisha's a man of God, inquires of him. He wants to know what the situation is going to be in him. He wants to, you know, wants to know what the outcome of this illness that he's suffering is going to be. So he sends an extravagant gift, with this messenger. I mean, that's a lot. I mean, 40 camel loads of swag. I mean, that's a lot of stuff to take to this guy and ask him. So, you know, from his side, he's going to do everything he can. I'm going to, you know, bribe this guy if necessary to get a good report from him and get a favorable forecast for what's going to happen to me. Don't you wish you could go to the doctor and do that? Here, I'll give you an extra $50 if you tell me I'm okay, you know, and make it true. But it doesn't, you know, it obviously doesn't work that way. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what his thinking is here. Again, we see that there's a level of superstition involved in this. He's viewing him probably more akin to a magician who's going to work some wonders, and he himself having this inherent power. It's interesting, you know, you wonder, the account, the text doesn't tell us at all if Elisha took that stuff or not. Now, when Naaman came and bought all kinds of goodies and stuff and said, here, you know, we brought all this stuff for you for my healing, he refused it. Remember, that was his whole thing. He refused it, and the idea behind it, the implication behind it was he didn't want to send out any kind of an indication that he had any power of his own to do this kind of stuff. This was what God was doing. This wasn't what Elisha himself, by some inherent power, was doing. So you figure, since it's kind of the same motive behind this, actually it's the same guy sending the presents. It was Ben-Hadad last time who sent all the you know, the fabulous door prizes over to Elisha. And so I'm assuming, I mean, I guess there's absolutely no way to prove it, but I mean, I'm going to assume and just feel good about it, is that Elisha turned this down as well. I mean, why would he take that once it's basically the same thing, just a different circumstance? Okay, verse 10. And Elisha said to him, to the servant who has come to him, go say to him, talking about the king, you shall certainly recover. However, the Lord shown me that he will really die. And then he set his countenance in a stare until he, that is Hazael, was ashamed. And the man of God wept. And Hazael said, why is my Lord weeping? And he answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you'll set on fire, and their young men you will kill with the sword, and you'll dash their children and rip open their women with child. So Hazael said, but what is your servant, a dog, that he should do this gross thing? And Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you will become king over Syria. All right, well, this is completely different than anybody would have expected. The question that Ben-Hadad asks originally becomes very important in this whole thing, in understanding what's happening here. Because what he's looking for from Elisha is an answer to the question, will I recover from this illness? What's going to happen because of this illness? How will this illness affect me? He didn't ask him, will I die? He doesn't say, am I going to die? He says, am I going to recover from this illness? So Elisha's answer is honest. You know, on the reading of it, the surface reading of it in the English, it almost seems like a trick. You know, go tell him he's going to be fine. The Lord told me he's going to die. It's not like that at all. He's saying he will recover from this disease. Yeah, the disease isn't going to kill him, but I did see that he's going to meet an untimely end. He's going to die earlier than he would have expected. So, you know, and then he begins, you know, obviously to see something inspired by the Lord, a vision begins to unfold for him, and he sees something here about these political machinations that are taking place that are going to unfold in Elisha's day. And listen, I'll tell you, around this time period in history, we know from the archaeological records that we have of this time, a great deal of turmoil was taking place all over the place, from the Assyrians to Syria to Israel, all around. There was political upheaval happening everywhere. So this is really interesting how this kind of unfolds here in this dramatic scene. And you can kind of imagine the scene. The text portrays it so well. The prophet is staring at this man, and they keep staring at him and keep staring at him. Clearly the Lord showing him something. And then all of a sudden he begins to cry. And then he's crying to where he's heaving sobs. And then the guy is getting embarrassed and kind of looking around going, you know, what's wrong, Elisha? What's happening here? And that's when he begins to explain to him what he's seen in this man's soul, what this man is going to be capable of doing to the children of Israel. Now, I think this is fascinating on so many levels as I consider this, because obviously Elisha is seeing into this guy's inner person, What is events that are going to be happening that are going to spring from who this man is and what it is that he's capable of doing. And you wonder about this. Was he seeing something here that that man himself wasn't even aware of, was inside of him? Was he seeing something here that even caught this man by surprise? Maybe, but it's doubtful. He sees this guy's ascent to a throne, and he sees all of the atrocities that he's going to commit against Israel, his own people, Elisha's own people. He sees this happening as a result of what this man is and what he's going to be able to do. And yet, all through this thing, there's no indication that Elisha has any power or will to try to stop him. How interesting is that? I mean, Elisha's an Israelite. These are his homies back at, back down to the south of him. He's looking at this guy. He knows what it is that he's going to do. I mean, he could just take him out right there. You know, Vulcan, and he's done, or something like that. I mean, come on. He's a prophet. He's been calling his predecessor, call down fire on people. It would be simple. And yet he doesn't do anything about it. Clearly, Elisha is recognizing that even in this horrible turn of events that's going to take place here, God's hand is at work. And he knows that judgment was going to be coming on the northern kingdom because of their abandonment of God's covenant with them. God had promised that. God had forecast it back in Deuteronomy 28, everything that was going to happen. He said, if you turn away from me, you have to turn aside from me, these are the events that are going to unfold. And this isn't to say that God is designing this for them, but God is not preventing this from happening. And he sees this, and here this man of God stands there, sees him, sees exactly what he is and what he's going to do, and yet he has no ability or power to stop him from doing it. So Hazi kind of looks at this, and he's not exactly sure, you know, how in the world this could happen. He says, you know, I've got as much authority as a dead dog. How am I going to pull something like this off? If you got a new King James or a King James that says, how am I going to do this gross thing? He doesn't mean gross like as in, ew, gross. He means the word, it's actually a very interesting word choice for the translators there. The word literally means something great, or it could be used in a positive sense, as in magnificent, or it could be used in the sense of immense, or it could be meaning haughty or something like this. So obviously he's seeing this as an immense kind of thing, as a large event. How is he going to be able to pull something like that off? Gross works, but it's just not a very contemporary word usage somehow. It just, but either way, you wonder about this guy then. Okay, so here's this interchange between the prophet and this guy who's a future, you know, atrocity committer. And you wonder, did he know this about himself? I mean, did he know that this was what he was destined to do? Did he have a plan already in place? Was he already thinking through the things that he would do if he could be king, if he could somehow take power? Was he already aware of things that he was planning on doing and just playing ignorant with Elisha, you know, to try to find out how Elisha would know something like this? Well, you know, how would I pull something like this off anyway? Or is he really asking him? Is he saying, how could I do something like this? I'm not anybody who's able to do that. Maybe, and this is the one that'll really get you scratching your noggin, maybe he hadn't thought of it until Elisha said it. I mean, maybe it becomes one of these crazy self-fulfilling prophecies that he hears this and he thinks, ooh, you know, that actually sounds good to me. I would like to do atrocities. Whatever it is that's working on there. I mean, I don't know. His response, though, shows us the evil that his heart is capable of, because when he hears about this, when he hears, I mean, the details that Elisha gives him, you don't even like to repeat. The imagery that it creates in your mind is horrific. And yet he doesn't recoil from that. He doesn't get back and say, no way. There's no way I would do something like that. He doesn't say anything like that. He doesn't say to Elisha, oh, please don't let that happen. Please don't let something like that happen because of me. No. He just wants to know the logistics of the thing. Well, how could I do something like that? I don't know how I would necessarily have the power. I think that is an amazing revelation about who this man is. Elisha then tells him, here's how it's going to happen. He tells him plainly, you are going to be the king of Syria. He doesn't tell him how he's going to become king. He doesn't say anything like that. He doesn't plan anything like that in his mind. He doesn't say, you know, give him any kind of instructions or anything like that. He just predicts that the throne is at some point going to be him. So whether this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's hard to say, but Ahazi had to fill in the details in his own mind somewhere along the way. Obviously, he's hearing these things, and all of a sudden, like tumblers on a lock, things begin to fall into place, and he starts thinking, wait a minute, I see how this could work. You know, it's not anything that he doesn't want to do. Obviously, God is working out his will and allowing things to take place on a fallen earth in order for his story to be unfolded so that the fullness of redemption can come. So God in his sovereignty is working things out, and yet this guy isn't going to do anything that he doesn't want to do. When we say like a self-fulfilling prophecy, I don't mean that in the sense that he's predestined to do it and he can't do anything else. I mean that in the sense that that was in his heart and he was willing to do it. And once he got the seed germinating in his mind and his heart, it was going to bear the fruit that it was going to bear because of who he was and what choices he was making. So verse 16, what happens then? Now in the fifth year, 14. Then he departed, this guy, Hazael, departed from Elisha. And he came to his master, who said to him, what did Elijah say to you? And he answered, hey, he told me you would surely recover. But it happened on the next day that he took a thick cloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face so that he died. And Hazael reigned in his place. Okay, so he gets back to the throne room. He gets back comes to the king, and the king asks him what the prognosis is going to be. And he tells him, hey, he said, you're going to recover. You're going to recover from this disease. Or at least he would have, given the opportunity. But Hazi has these treasonous designs set in motion. So he takes a thick cloth, and he soaks it in water, and he lays it over the king's face. Obviously, the king is sick enough to where he's debilitated and isn't able to fight back well enough, and he suffocates him. And so this is his rise to power. Now, here's what's really interesting. Well, I mean, it's all interesting. Well, maybe it's not interesting to you. It is to me. But the thing that's interesting that's on a side note of this is that archaeology corroborates this story. In the late 1800s, a statue of Shalmaneser III, the Assyrian king, was discovered, and it was covered with inscriptions all over it. And one of the inscriptions reads that Ben-Hadad died, speaking of the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad died, Hazael, the son of nobody, seized the throne. That's inscribed in there. The archaeologists found this a long time ago and translated it, and we realized then that historically that's borne out. And so many of the events that take place here that are described in the books of Kings are actually corroborated within Assyrian texts that have been found in inscriptions and various steles? Yeah. And actually in 1993, the Tel Dan stele was discovered. And that one is a very important discovery because it was erected on behalf of Hazael, the king, after his victories in military battle over the Israelites. So it was erected in the area of Israel, and it's one of the only archaeological evidences that actually points to the throne of David. It actually talks in there about how he defeated the ancestors of the throne of David. Why is that interesting? Because there is actually no other archaeological evidence in all the world of King David's rule. That's the one piece of archaeological evidence that verifies the reality of King David and his rule on earth. Now, think about this for just a moment. Here we are, thousands of years removed from this situation. This heinous man who rose to power and did these terrible things and committed these atrocities and conquered parts of Israel was able to erect this pillar that had these inscriptions in it that verify for us today the reality of the biblical record that we've received. Wow. I think that's cool. I think God is cool like that, and how he does stuff like that just kind of makes your head spin as you try to piece together and put together the reality of how he's been at work and how detailed his plan is and how far-reaching it extends to, how we're still so completely included in it. Because I don't know about you, but I read about stuff like that, and I see something like this, and I realize that I am part of this story. The very fact that I'm able to research this and see this stuff today, and it's today's news tells me then that I'm part of this amazing, epic story that's unfolding, that's been unfolding for so long. Okay, settle down, Rob. Just get back to what you were talking about. Verse 16. Okay, now the story kind of changes. We're done with that story. Let's go to a different story. Verse 16. Now, in the fifth year of Yoram, or Yehoram, it's the same name, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, having been king of Judah, Yehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, began to reign as king of Judah. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in the ways, in the way of the kings of Israel, just as the house of as Ahab had done. For the daughter of Ahab was his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for the sake of his servant David, as he promised to give him a lamp to him and his sons forever. In his days, Edom revolted against Judah's authority and made a king over themselves. So Yoram went to Zair, and all his chariots with him, and then he rose by night and attacked the Edomites, who had surrounded him, and the captains, the chariots, and the troops fled their tents. Thus Edom had been in revolt against Judah's authority to this day. And Libnah revolted at that time. Now, the rest of the acts of Yoram and all that he did, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Yoram rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his place. Okay, so basically what we've done here is, this is kind of like meanwhile in the southern kingdom, and we get this story of the kings, the king who had taken over the son of Jehoshaphat. Now, it gets confusing because of the names. Clearly, the name Yehoram was a very popular name in those days. Lots of kids named Yehoram, and so much so that we've got two different kings, one in the north and one in the south, both with the same name. One is Yehoram, son of Ahab, the other, or Ahab, or the other is Yehoram, son of Jehoshaphat. The other thing to get it nice and confusing is that every once in a while they refer to him as Yoram, which is kind of like Jack and John. You know how it's the same name, and it could be confusing, at least if you're a little kid, but then later on you understand, so it's the same person. So this is what we're talking about. It said that he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel like Ahab, and of course that's not a compliment. The kings of Israel had several kings, many kings now, and every single one of them had been described as evil, as doing things that were not right in the eyes of God. So this is a corruption now of the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom has at least kept to the ways of the Lord, of God's covenant, at least, you know, on the surface. It talks here about the Canaanite religion being involved in this. Well, it talks in 2 Chronicles about the Canaanite religion being involved in the practices now in Judah. His wife is the daughter of Jezebel, who is Ahab's wife. Her name was Atalia, that lady. And it doesn't mention it in here. That's all in 2 Chronicles. So obviously, this was a disastrous alliance that was developed. This happened back in the days of Jehoshaphat. He had started this alliance with the northern kingdom, and nothing ever good came of it. When Jehoshaphat we first see him allied with the northern kingdom, he's up there with Ahab, and Ahab tricks him into wearing royal robes out onto the battlefield while Ahab is sneaking around just like a normal foot soldier. So, you know, Jehoshaphat's running for his life and screaming, and it's a big mess. And nothing has ever come out of that kind of an alliance that's been good. Things to keep in mind when we're thinking about, you know, life decisions and choices that we have to make, and alliances that we make in life. Any kind of alliance that we're going to make to the flesh, any kind of alliance that we start to develop with any kind of habit that, you know, it's left over from the fall in us, is not going to end well. It's going to end up the same way that this kind of stuff ends up, going from bad to worse and becoming problematic. So we learn from those things. We don't want to follow in those kinds of footsteps. God doesn't judge him. You know, the text indicates that he was deserving of judgment, but God doesn't judge him for the sake of David. And again, we think back to the amazing, long-reaching effects that David had, the impact that he made. What an impact one person can make when their heart is passionate for God. It lingers on in the earth, and this man is spared from judgment because of David. For David's sake, that's an amazing thing. So Judah's strength, we see, is that, you know, as it's explaining about the different kingdoms, Edom in revolt, We see that Judah's strength is beginning to dwindle, so that this alliance with the northern kingdom, maybe somewhere along the way, they were thinking, well, this will make us stronger. We'll have, you know, twice the power of, you know, we'll be like amazing Israelites. And it turns out it actually is having the absolute opposite effect, that their power and their influence is beginning to dwindle. They're not having the effect that they want. Again, another reminder, we think about those things. We look at all the different ways that the world and this culture and the values of this world would like to maneuver us, getting us to adopt the values of this world, to ally ourselves with this world. And the idea behind it is, well, I need to do this so that I can have the strength or the power, the ability that I need, or the resources I need to accomplish something else. And yet it's usually the opposite that's true. It's usually a drain on and a weakening of our influence as light in the world. So we want to be careful about those kinds of things. Keep those things in mind when we consider the choices that we make in life. Second Chronicles, 21 goes into a lot more details about the life of this king, and you can look that up, and of course we'll get there one day. So he was not, it wasn't good. He actually, we find out that in his death he dies, and he does die in a premature way. Elisha sends word and a warning to him, and it was right on the heels of that he dies suddenly. So we pick up verse 25. In the 12th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, the king of Israel, Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mom's name was that lady again, the granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. And he walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord like the house of Ahab, for he was the son-in-law of the house of Ahab. It only makes sense. And he went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to war against Hazael, the king of Syria, that guy. Remember, we just read about him at Ramoth-Gilead, and the Syrians wounded Joram. Then King Joram went back to Jezreel to recover from the wounds which the Syrians had inflicted on him at Ramah, and he fought against Hazael and the king of Syria. And Ahaziah, the son of Jeroham, king of Judah, went down to see Joram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel, because he was sick because of that wound. Okay, so you can see what's going on here. This is just, Ahaziah takes over the throne of Judah. Again, this alliance is there. They go to war against the very guy that we saw who was going to become king. And we know even from history, these wars don't go well for Israel. And in the process, Jeroham of the northern kingdom is wounded. And so Ahaziah goes up to go hang out with him, take some flowers and sit by his bedside to comfort him because he's sick. And that's where the story ends for tonight. And the story will continue. We'll pick up where we left off next time. So Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the story that includes us to this day. We thank you for the warnings that we see. We thank you for the encouragements that are there in your word to remind us who we belong to remind us that you're in control and that you work all things together for our good, just like you did with that Shunammite woman. So encourage our hearts, Father, to continue following you, serving you, and making choices that are in harmony with the character of a living God. We pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Any questions or comments or anything about tonight?